everyone. And last week, Prabhupada Priya, Devi Dasi, gave a very nice class, and she talked about how Krishna is all good, and everything Krishna does is good, and really got into the intricacies of, well, how can that be? Why is it? And sometimes we see that there's so many difficulties that things don't always seem good. So I was thinking about those themes and how to kind of continue in the same direction. How is it that there's so much distress in the world, but yet Krishna is saying that it's very possible to be happy even within this world? So I was looking at a couple verses in Bhagavad Gita, which I thought were very appropriate for a situation, and like to talk about that. In the Bhagavad Gita 266, we'll start with, by the way, the title of the talk is Inner Peace Within a Pandemic. 266. Nasti buddhir ayuktasya na cha yuktasya bhavana na cha bhavayata shantir ashantasya kuta sukam. Srila Prabhupada's translation and purport. One who is not connected with the Supreme in Krishna consciousness can have neither transcendental intelligence nor a steady mind, without which there is no possibility of peace. And how can there be any happiness without peace? Report. Unless one is in Krishna consciousness, there is no possibility of peace. So it is confirmed in the fifth chapter, 529, that when one understands that Krishna is the only enjoyer of all the good results of sacrifice and penance, that he is the proprietor of all the universal manifestations, and that he is the real friend of all living entities, then only can one have real peace. Therefore, if one is not in Krishna consciousness, there cannot be a final goal for the mind. Disturbance is due to want of an ultimate goal. And when one is certain that Krishna is the enjoyer, proprietor, and friend of everyone and everything, then one can, with a steady mind, bring about peace. Therefore, one who is engaged without a relationship with Krishna is certainly always in distress and is without peace, however much he may make a show of peace and spiritual advancement. Krishna consciousness is a self-manifested, peaceful condition which can be achieved only in relationship with Krishna. A very, very nice purport, Srila Prabhupada is explaining how one can actually feel peaceful and how if one does not have that relationship or connection with Krishna, there really can be no happiness and there's only distress. In this purport, Prabhupada refers to and quotes extensively from 529, which is, of course, Bhokta Ram Jagadhapa Samsara Valoka Maheshwaram Suhridim Sarvabhutanam Atpamam Shantim Nishtiti. A person in full consciousness of me, knowing me to be the ultimate beneficiary of all sacrifice and austerities, the Supreme Lord of all the planets and demigods, and the benefactor and well-wisher of all living entities, attains peace from the pangs of material miseries. Well, I think that we're all experiencing and we're all seeing the material world is filled with misery. There's so much unhappiness, so much distress. If it isn't from a pandemic, then it's from war, or from drought, or famine, or from hurricanes, or tornadoes, or something. There's always some distressful condition in this material world. And also distress to the mind, as well as to the body. So the goal that Krishna is talking about in the Bhagavad Gita is how, through spiritual consciousness, to attain peace from that distress situation. So the first point that Srila Prabhupada makes is to understand that the material world means being in distress. There will always be distress. Being in this world of matter means distress. And that will be there until we recognize Krishna's position. And that's there even for a devotee. Even for a devotee who might recognize Krishna, still will experience some distress just by virtue of being in this material world. So what does one do? Well, Krishna says, you have to learn to tolerate that. It says, Matra Sparshita Kuntaya, Shri Krishna, Sukadukada, Agamapayanonicha, Stangsitiksha Shvabharata. The non-permanent appearance of happiness and distress and their disappearance in due course are like the appearance and disappearance of winter and summer seasons. They arise from sense perception, and one must learn to tolerate them without being disturbed. So this is the very beginning in the second chapter of Krishna's instructions to Arjuna. And he says you have to tolerate happiness and distress, but he gives some hints as to how that is done, which will later unfold, be unfolded and unpacked when the official explain it in much more detail. Firstly, he says they arise from sense perception. So in other words, it has to do with one's understanding or thinking that one is one's body and from one's senses. And you have to tolerate those without being disturbed. So there's the indication here, and then the next few verses, of course, go on to explain the difference between the body and the spirit, and how the spirit is not really affected by these material distresses. Well, these recent events can certainly give us a vivid example of the different material pain that is in the world, and a lesson in tolerance of how we have to all develop a certain tolerance. Because the Bhagavad Gita does describe material world as skalayam ashashvatam. It is full of suffering, and it is temporary. Suffering is temporary, and happiness is also temporary. Even if one can maintain, or thinks one can maintain, happiness throughout this life, if there's no great distress, eventually it's taken away at the time of death. So we know that later the Gita, the next verse, the Gita says, Abhamabhavanaloka, Narabharchanarjuna, from the highest planet in the material world down to the lowest, all are places of misery, wherein repeated birth and death take place. So that's the problem. The problem is clear. Birth, death, disease, and old age. People are miserable. People are in happiness world. If we left it at that, it would be pretty depression. But fortunately, there's a solution. And the solution Krishna gives us is what Prabhupada called the peace formula. And it's recognizing these three things. That Krishna is the supreme controller, Sarvaloka Maheshwaram. That Krishna is also the enjoyer of all sacrifice, and he is the supreme friend and well-wisher of all living entities. So first of all, God is the supreme controller. You may think, okay, well, yes, we can understand God's in control, but that's a very profound statement, and it's a very profound realization if one actually realizes that and incorporates in his life. Because if God is the supreme controller, that implies that we are not the supreme controller, or even very big controllers, and we only control a tiny portion of this universe. The assumption of human progress, the assumption the materialist makes of what defines human progress, is the degree of control we have over material life, material existence. To the degree that we can control things, we think, we are making real progress. We are modern. We are scientific. We are advancing. So if we can control disease to some degree, if we can control our economic circumstances, if we can give ourselves more material comforts, we think that this is progress towards happiness. But we know, our spiritual understanding from Bhagavad Gita, is that is an illusion of control. It's an illusion of happiness. And it begins with the bodily conception. The first covering of a maya is called ahankara, that I am the body. The thinking, the false identity, that I am this body, I am this mind, I am these senses, that is the first covering of illusion. And after one identifies with the body, what's next? The next illusion is that one is in control. I have these body, I have these senses, they're able to do things, I'm able to move, I'm able to act, therefore I have some control. And one thinks that those bodily and sensual activities that they are controlling are going to bring about happiness. But if one desires happiness, and our entire society and culture is striving to increase human happiness, the question remains, why is there so much distress? Why is there so much unhappiness? Because the reality is we do have no real control. Everything is going on by the laws of nature. Everything is going on by the divine will of the Lord, through his agencies, through his variegated energies. It's all going on outside of ourselves. Just as we can see, we have no control over the passage of time. The passage of time causes an anticipation of happiness. Something will happen in the future. But then it causes an equal sense of loss. An example I think Prabhupada gives is the birth of a child is awaited. Eager anticipation for time to pass. But years later, our passing years are dreaded. It becomes a source of distress for us. When we're young, we want to grow up. We want to get a driver's license. We want to graduate. We want to get in the world. Then, after a while, after so many years and decades pass, we are old and we wish we were young. And we think, why did I want to be old so fast? Now I wish I could enjoy the body and senses like I used to when I was a young man. So we can't control the passing of time. We can't control our happiness and distress. Prabhupada would say, the reality of this material world is no one wants suffering, and yet it comes. And one who's intelligent understands this. The Bhagavad Gita, 13th chapter, says that one of the symptoms of knowledge is the perception of the evils of birth, death, disease, and old age. This is knowledge. Because the understanding is that these things come about whether we want them or not, and happiness also comes about on its own accord. In fact, that experience of happiness that we sometimes think, oh, I'm very happy, is really a cessation of pain. When things aren't too bad, when things aren't too miserable, they go, oh, I'm happy now. I like this quote I mentioned before, the great Albert Schweitzer, who I think he won a Nobel Peace Prize about a century ago. He was a doctor, a missionary in Africa. And he said, happiness is nothing more than good health and a bad memory. So today, yesterday I was feeling good. I forget the day before I had coronavirus, I had COVID-19. Anyway, that's how it is. We want to forget those things in the material world. So science wants to defeat material nature, conquer material nature, and they think that that is their success. You would think that it was almost funny, except it's not funny, to think how are human beings going to conquer nature? First of all, the attempt is futile. I was thinking that we have hurricane season every year here in Florida, and they try to predict how many hurricanes, and they're always wrong, they can't predict them. Sometimes they think they don't realize something's going to happen, and a terrible storm comes out of nowhere and destroys things. Last year, they were predicting all these hurricanes that were supposed to be so bad, and they kind of fizzled out, and nothing happened. They cannot predict these things. What to speak of controlling it? There's the economics. The science of economics is there, but yet they can't prevent recessions or inflation, these wild fluctuations. If they're so intelligent, why is it the stock market crashes one day, thousands of points, then it bounces back the next day? No control. And now we're seeing this widespread distress and even panic over this coronavirus pandemic. Now, I was thinking about it, I looked up a little bit, what is a virus? A virus is a tiny, tiny, small, insignificant microorganism. In fact, some scientists say it's not even really a microorganism. There's even debate about whether it's actually alive or not. Well, of course, according to the Vedic understanding, it does fulfill enough of those symptoms of life that we'd say there's life there, because it does replicate, it lives, it dies, etc. But it is so small and insignificant. It's much, much less than a bacteria or a protozoa. So they're not even sure whether it's actually life. Because one thing they say, it can only replicate inside a host body. Well, that is reproduction, which is one of the signs of life, but it can't do it on its own. Sitting out here on the marble floor, it has to go into your body to start reproducing, and that's when you get sick, of course. The other thing that's interesting about it, it's very fragile. Apparently, it has a coating which is made of lipids, which are fats, and those are very, very fragile. They're killed by soap, you spray them with Clorox or Lysol, you heat to 133 degrees, the virus is dead. So this little tiny thing, which is so fragile, we're not talking about Hiranyakasipu or some huge demon here. We're talking about a tiny little thing. But this tiny virus is defeating science. It's defeating the civilization. It's practically bringing it to its knees. It's destroying the economy. It's destroying so many things. So many people are dying by this tiny little insignificant living entity. And science can do very little about it. Now, of course, they will develop a vaccine. But they say it'll take 1 year to develop and test a vaccine. And by that time, of course, it's mutated and we get a different type of a virus or different type of SARS or MERS or whatever it is for the next year. So this endlessly goes on. Science is always letting us, telling us how they are going to conquer death. And Prabhupada would always say, yes, this is like giving you a post-dated blank check. Post-dated blank check. Yes, in the future. In the future, we'll be able to control this. So this is what we're dealing with. No control over so many things in life. And sometimes those great advances in science create more harm than good, like nuclear weapons. Nuclear energy could do so many things, produce electricity. It can also blow up millions of people. Look at the automobile. We all like automobiles. We all drive them. You know, I'm not saying we don't. But when you think about the pollution, the expense, the energy crisis, the wars over oil, so many things have happened because of cars. Probably gave this example that, you know, it's like it almost causes more difficulty than value. It's interesting that one thing that is being seen is in major cities, the pollution level is actually way down now. Since all of this quarantine and all of this isolation, people aren't driving, so the pollution level goes down. The cars are causing, you know, so much pollution there when people are just doing their ordinary driving. This is what Prabhupada called Maya Sukhaya. Actually, Prahlad Maharaj called it Maya Sukhaya, and Prabhupada would often quote that. This is from a lecture in 1974 in Mayapur. Prabhupada said, actually, this is a fact. We have a humbug civilization. So many cars are being manufactured every year, and for that purpose, so many roads have to be excavated and prepared. This creates problem after problem. Therefore, it is Maya Sukhaya, illusory happiness. And yet, we are trying to be happy in this way. So, we see that we can't really control material nature. Our attempts to control sometimes cause more harm than good. And this third issue is actually the most important. We're ignoring the real problem of life. What is the real problem of life? Birth, death, old age, and disease. And having no focus on spiritual life, on a spiritual solution for those problems. We must recognize that these things are imposed upon us by a superior power. And until we recognize that Krishna is that supreme Ishvara, that supreme controller, we will have nothing but difficulty and distress. So, secondly, Krishna tells us we must understand him as the beneficiary of all sacrifices, which means everything is meant to be offered to him. We do everything for his pleasure, simply put. We offer our service for Krishna's pleasure, and then we become happy. It is not that we become slaves or we become subservient or unhappy. No. When we are serving, we are fully happy because we are in our constitutional position, in our Sanatana Dharma, our Sarup, where we are meant to be situated. When we try to enjoy independently, we lose that connection with God. When we lose our real identity as a spirit soul, a servant, a part and parcel of God. We are just like the fish out of water or someone who's in an artificial atmosphere. If we're not in our real position of life, you can't be happy no matter what you do. This was such an important teaching that one of the principal, most important disciples, devotees of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sanatana Goswami, the oldest and head of the six Goswamis of Vrindavan, went to see Lord Chaitanya. And he said in his very humble way, he said, I'm considered a learned man. People respect me. And he was. Extremely intelligent, knew all kinds of languages. He was the minister to the king, the closest advisor. You know, he said, I don't even know my purpose in life. Who am I? Why am I suffering? That's what he asked Rajasthani. Those were intelligent questions. Who am I really? What is my purpose? Why am I suffering? That is what an intelligent person asks. And Lord Chaitanya begins his instructions, Shivara Surupaya, Krishnara Nichidas, Krishnara Tatashta Shakti, Vedabaya Prakash. It is a living entity's constitutional position to be an eternal servant of Krishna. because he is the marginal energy of Krishna and a manifestation simultaneously one with and different from the Lord, like a molecular particle of sunshine or fire. Krishna has a variety, three varieties of energy. So that's a very, very full statement, and it could take a couple classes to kind of go through everything that's contained within this beautiful statement of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in Majjhalila 2108. But at any rate, Jivara Swarup Vaya Krishna Nityadas, the living entities, Swarup, our real position is eternal servant of Krishna. So Lord Chaitanya goes on to explain to Sanatana Goswami about his different energies, and then he says in verse 117, forgetting Krishna, the living entity has been attracted by the external feature from time immemorial. Therefore, the illusory energy gives him all kinds of miseries in this material existence, samsara. So our suffering material world comes from this forgetfulness of Krishna and forgetting our real position as servant of Krishna. And when we reestablish that relationship with Krishna in bhakti, devotional service, we become happy. We become peaceful. We become free from distress. And finally, Krishna is the well-wisher and the friend of the living entity. Krishna's desire is for us to return to him, going back to Godhead, and not to suffer this material world. Some might say, well, then why is it that he allows so much suffering? Krishna may allow it. He may sanction it, but he doesn't desire it. He allows the living entity to fulfill their own destinies, to fulfill their minute, independent spirit. If we want to try to enjoy independently, you can't do it in Krishna's kingdom because there's only one God there. So you come to this material world and you get to try and be little gods here on your own. Now, the downside is the material world, unlike the spiritual world, is not eternal. It is not full of happiness, and it is not full of knowledge, the qualities of the spiritual world. Therefore, we will also, while we are trying to enjoy, be controllers, be little gods ourselves, we will also experience distress in this material world. But it is not his desire. Krishna wants us to come back to him. Krishna wants to befriend us and to help us to understand our spiritual position. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9:29, Samoham sarvabhuteshu namedveshu sinatriya ye vijanti kumam bhaktya mayi teteshu chakyaham. I envy no one, nor am I partial to anyone. I am equal to all. In other words, whatever you want, whatever your desire is, Krishna will fulfill that. But whoever renders service unto me in devotion is a friend, is in me, and I am also a friend to him. He said a very important point, Srila Prabhupada explains in the purport. He says, one may question here that if Krishna is equal to everyone, and no one is his special friend, then why does he take a special interest in the devotees who are always engaged in his transcendental service? But this is not discrimination, it is natural. Any man in this material world may be very charitably disposed, yet he has a special interest in his own children. The Lord claims that every living entity, in whatever form, is his son, and he provides everyone with a generous supply of the necessities of life. He is just like a cloud which pours rain all over, regardless of whether it falls on rock or land or water. But for his devotees, he gives specific attention. In other places, Prabhupada explained that analogy of the cloud and the rain, which pours water everywhere. The rain is very munificent, very merciful. It pours rain on the ocean, on the rock, on places that really can't benefit, as well as on fertile fields. So if the living entity is a fertile field, if we are willing to accept the mercy of Krishna, then it is there fully, and that mercy will blossom for that devotee. So Krishna is kind to all the conditioned souls. If he weren't kind to the conditioned souls, he would not make special arrangement to reclaim us, to bring us back to him. And he did so when he manifested in the appearance of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu 500 some years ago. Lord Chaitanya is often called the most merciful, or most magnanimous, most munificent incarnation or expansion of Krishna, Namo Mahavaranaya Krishna Prema Pradayate, because he gives us the easiest process of self-realization, simply chanting the holy names of the Lord, but is also the highest, most sublime philosophy contained within the teachings of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he gives us the highest philosophy with the easiest process of simply chanting Hare Krishna. And so he inaugurates the Sankirtan movement to deliver all the jivas in Kali Yuga, any minute for everyone. The Hare Krishna movement to go to every town and village. And Srila Prabhupada, of course, helped fulfill that desire of Lord Chaitanya, bringing the Hare Krishna movement, bringing this mantra to every town and village in the United States, in Europe, in Africa, in South America, in Europe, Australia, Asia, all over. So this is the primary process to understand Krishna, to reach this peaceful situation of knowing Krishna as the Supreme Controller, the Supreme Friend, the Supreme Proprietor. And it's done simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord. This chanting allows us to experience Krishna, become purified, and experience the taste of the bliss of our relationship with Krishna. I was just thinking that, of course, Sankirtan, congregational chanting, is the heart and soul of devotees. And of course, we have not so much opportunity now to come together to chant congregationally. Yet at the same time, any devotee's home you go to, or any temple, or all day throughout the temple, will be playing kirtan and bhajans, and the chanting is there everywhere. So we have such a wonderful opportunity due to our technology that wouldn't have been there 20, 30, 40 years ago, that we can actually experience the chanting of Hare Krishna everywhere, if we're in our homes, in our cars, wherever we are, simply by listening to so many recordings that there are of the chanting. Right? So many wonderful singers, wonderful bhajan, kirtan leaders, and of course, through the Prabhupada. I was just hearing today, I think it was the temple's broadcast, which was starting, of Srila Prabhupada chanting his original, the original tune of the Hare Krishna mantra. So simple, so basic, yet so beautiful. And it's one that I've heard for 45 years now, and I've never become tired of. That's the nature, the spiritual nature of the holy name, especially as it comes from the lips of a pure devotee. The purity of a holy name comes through, it emanates, it pierces the material coverings, it pierces the ears, and comes into our heart. So we still have that opportunity. We have that opportunity to chant and to hear, to read, to come together in many ways. And I know there's also a lot of opportunities where many temples are starting to put on interactive different events. I'm sure you can find them all over on the internet. And I know Vaisheshika in California was doing all these programs, and some of the other devotees. And some of I was just reading some of the GBC things today on their forums. They were talking about setting up interactive times people can chant japa together. And so many ways we can keep connected. Because that's so important. Due to our independent nature and forgetfulness of God, we may think sometimes that he is unfeeling or he's forgetful of us, but it's not a fact. Krishna does give all protection to his devotees. We might say, well, devotees that have died, even a couple of devotees have died of this epidemic so far. Well, the material body is not always going to be saved. The material body will die. That's a fact. We're in this material world, whether it's today, tomorrow. Prabhupada was saying this. He says, I'm an old man. I can go anytime. So that is not what we mean. But he will save us spiritually, protect us spiritually. He will make sure that we advance in spiritual life, that our endeavor is never in vain, that it does continue. From whatever point we leave, we continue from there. So we have firm faith in Krishna's plan. Sometimes even if we don't see it. Like in the current situation, what is Krishna's plan? I wish I could tell you. But I can't. Because I don't know. I don't see it. I don't know if anybody sees it. But Krishna has a plan. And somehow or another, either we will come more together, we will become stronger, people will become so distressed, they'll turn to Krishna consciousness, something. Krishna has a plan here, you know, for all of our things. Sometimes Krishna's plan is simply that we have to learn to depend on him and surrender and have faith. That's also part of his plan. So we have to think in our current situation, whatever it is, what do I need to learn? What does Krishna have in store for me? What is my personal learning here that I need? I was thinking that one very small benefit, you could say a silver lining in a very bad situation of not coming to the temple. Actually, I was thinking that just before this happened, I was starting to enjoy more and more coming to the temple and greeting the deities and offering my flowers to Prabhupada and praying to Prabhupada and praying to the deities. You know, of course, we all do. But sometimes you feel a little more intensely, and I was really appreciating it even more, and now it's cut off. So, one thing that we can learn is love and separation. This was actually Lord Chaitanya's teaching. His deepest inner teaching was teaching love and separation as exemplified by Radharani and the gopis, right? Now, that's pretty esoteric, and I mean, not like, I certainly can barely understand that at many deeper levels, but yet, we can all understand that sense of separation that we have from the association of devotees, our separation from seeing the deities in person every day, from seeing Srila Prabhupada, worshiping Srila Prabhupada. Maybe it's taking prasadam. That's a spiritual separation also, coming to this wonderful Sunday program. I know I have to honestly admit that in the past sometimes I didn't come to the Sunday program real regularly, but in like the last year or so, I've come almost every Sunday because of a certain service I have here. And I've found how much I've appreciated it. And seeing the devotees and talking to them and interacting and having just, you know, a lot of really, really nice relationships with the devotees and feeling a sense of serving them as well. So these are all things that we take for granted, and now maybe we miss that a little bit. And if we feel some pangs of separation, it's not a bad thing. It's kind of good to feel some separation because this will end, as all things end, sometime, whether it's a few weeks, whenever it is, and we will so much more appreciate coming together. We will so much appreciate coming together for kirtan and sadhu sangha and sitting together here in the Bhagavatam. As ecstatic as this is to speak to this empty room, except for one faithful, wonderful devotee here manning the controls from Govinda Prabhu, but I know that you are all out there on the internet and the radios. Yeah. And so the association is there, but it will be so much sweeter when we have a personal association again. So we can look forward to that. And hopefully we'll learn from that. And in the meantime, we have to observe these things very, very carefully. Because as much as I value the association devotees, what I value even more is that all of you stay safe and stay healthy, and that you all survive and are well so that we can all come back together. And that's the most important thing. A little sacrifice now to take care of all of our community of Vaishnavas. Okay, well, I have a few minutes, and I'm just going to spend about just a couple minutes here talking about, this is the appearance day of Ramanujacharya. And just a couple quick things about Ramanujacharya. He's, of course, the modern leader of the Sri or the Lakshmi Sampradaya. You know, as we all know, we have the four Vaishnava Sampradayas, the Brahma Sampradaya, the Lakshmi or Sri Sampradaya, the Shiva Sampradaya, and the Kumara Sampradaya. And each one of those had a sort of in the more modern era, we say modern, for the last 1,000 years, you know, we had Madhvacharya, we had Ramanujacharya, we had Nimbarka, and Vishnuswami as the four more representatives of it. So Ramanujacharya was the leader of the Sri Sampradaya about 1,000 years ago, and he represented a philosophy called Vishtavaitavada, or specific monism, which means, this is from Adi 7.101, the Supreme Lord is the only reality and truth. Advaita. Yet he accepts the distinct designation, the shishta, of chit and achit, the transcendental and the material. So in other words, we're getting into a little bit of understanding, not exactly Chintaveda Vedatattva, but he's coming a little bit close. So he's saying, yes, there's only one supreme truth. There's only one God. In other words, not that there are many demigods that are equal, but that there's one supreme Lord, but he has different designations, different energies, chit and achit. So his philosophy, it's stated in Adiveda 7.1.10, was a stumbling block to the Mayavadis because they defeat their philosophy in scrupulous detail. Students of Vedic philosophy know very well how strongly Sri Ramanujacharya's Vishnu-Dvaitavada and Sri Madhvacharya's Tattvavada contest in personal Mayavada philosophy. So they were very, very strong preachers. Their writings and philosophy were very strong and defeated impersonalism. Sripad Ramanujacharya has also refuted the arguments of Shankar in his own commentary, Vedanta Sutra, known as Srivasya. And there's an extensive quote of Ramanuja's arguments against impersonalism in Adi 541 that Srila Prabhupada writes about. So some of the key points, Lord Chaitanya took, and I believe Brandavinda spoke about this morning, that Lord Chaitanya took 8 principal philosophical points, 2 from each of the sampradayas, and he put those together, the best of each one, and came up with the Chintaveda Vedatattva. So he took the tenets of bhakti, unpolluted by karma and jnana, right? And service to the Vaishnavas. In other words, not just the Kanishtha understanding of serving in the temple, but the one serves the devotees, the Vaishnavas. I don't know if there were others, but those were two, I think, principal ones that he taught. Here's just a few things about his life. He lived from about 1017 to 1137. That looks like 120 years.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. Long, long life. Here's one pastime that I found. It said the seat of the Acharya of Sri Rangam was lying vacant without a successor to take over. Ramanujacharya was prevailed upon to assume charge, but before doing so, he wanted to equip himself with the secrets of the 3 great mantras. For this purpose, he approached one Churuk Kushtiyur Nambi, who made him come several times before actually instructing him. He cautioned Ramanuja that he should not give out the secrets to all and sundry, and if he did so, he would go to hell. So he's giving him 3 secret mantras and saying, if you give these to anybody else, you'll go to hell. Immediately upon receiving the instructions, what did he do? Ramanuja climbed to the top of the steeple of the temple and proclaimed to a large gathering of his disciples assembled there the purport of the instruction. By the time of this episode, he had already gathered a huge following of disciples who congregated at the main entrance of the temple, and he was thus addressing his own disciples. The well-known Acharya, Thirukkoshityur Nambi, was so enraged, demanded an explanation. Ramanuja replied that he did not give out the secrets, and even if he had transgressed the specific warning of the Guru, only he himself would go to hell, but the multitude of humanity that listened would be saved spiritually. Obviously, that's the heart of a devotee, a great Vaishnava who doesn't care for himself. I may go to hell, but let me give this secret to everybody else. The Guru was overwhelmed by this reply. Embracing Ramanuja, appreciating his broad-mindedness, he called him Impura Manur, or O My Lord, and declared Sri Vaishnavism would henceforth be known as Ramanuja Darshanam, the light of Ramanuja. So, of course, he was very, very influential. Had many, many thousands of disciples and helped to spread Vaishnavism, particularly all throughout South India. And the Sri Vaishnavas are still very, very strong, very prominent in South India. Many, many temples there that come from his lineage. So a wonderful Vaishnavacharya. I'm sure there's so many more pastimes, but that's all we have for now. So in the meantime, for those of you who are tuning in late, we are here in an empty temple room because the temple is now closed due to the coronavirus pandemic and all of the stay-at-home orders. Many, many temples throughout the country are closing now. It's really just too difficult to try to keep the social isolation and distancing needed to be able to stop this virus. So we're actually closing the temple. There'll be nobody coming to the temple other than the pujaris. We're absolutely necessary. We'll continue to have one speaker come for the Bhagavatam class every morning, and of course everything will be recorded and everything will be live over our YouTube broadcast, and we also will be playing a variety of music and programs, devotional programs throughout the day. So please continue to appreciate Krishna consciousness through the internet and through your phones and other means. And hopefully this will only last a short time, hopefully just a few weeks, and we'll all be able to come back together again. So in the meantime, be very, very careful. It's a very serious thing. It's spreading very quickly in all parts of the country and all parts of the world. So, you know, stay safe and depend upon the guidance and mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Sri Krishna, our wonderful deities, and of course, His Divine Grace, Sri Prabhupada. Jai. Hare Bol.
Jai. Hare Prabhupada.